very concerned about the questions that were asked. I think that there is something to hide, that they're not presenting that today.
A controversial process to review the Pebble Mine science studies. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, October 2nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an optimistic assessment of the potential for shale oil in Alaska.
We're maybe 5 years from now that we are putting 500,000 barrels or more a day of shale oil into the taps line.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by Era Alaska. For more than 30 years, Era Alaska has been transporting packages across the state, business documents, medical supplies, even family pets. More details at flyera.com or talk to your local Era Alaska agent. Era Alaska, bringing Alaskans together.
A woman was found dead this morning in an Anchorage church parking lot, and police say she is the victim of a homicide. Police Lieutenant Dave Parker says two neighbors spotted the woman and attempted to come to her aid. They called police at 8:14 a.m. She was in the parking lot of the Anchorage Unitarian Universalist Fellowship Church on Turnigan Avenue in West Anchorage. The woman has not been identified. Parker says she was wearing a brown shirt and black pants and had auburn hair. Hunks of styrofoam, floats, some barrels, and a basketball are some of the things that are turning up on Alaska shores from the Japan tsunami of 2011. More will be coming, borne by Trans-Pacific Ocean currents. Today, the statewide public radio call-in show Talk of Alaska got an update on tsunami debris. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is tracking the debris as best it can, relying on reports from mariners, pilots, and satellite imagery, though NOAA's Alaska Area Debris Coordinator Peter Murphy says a lot of material is now too small to be picked up by satellite.
Right after the event, so I mean the days right afterwards, you could actually see the debris in big bands, kind of islands of debris off the coast of Japan. But those quickly dissipated, so within a few weeks it was too spread out, sea debris with that resolution of satellite. So now we're looking with higher resolution satellites across the Pacific, but even then it's hard to find the debris because it just presents a small target.
NOAA enters everything it finds on its website, which by this time includes 1,300 reports of sightings. The website is updated at least once a week and available to the public.
So we receive the reports in by email and then enter it into a tracking database. And then from that, we do put them on a map. We put yellow push pins for objects that could be from the tsunami, and then red ones for ones we're able to confirm, so actually go back and be able to say definitely this came from the tsunami. And we put those up on a map that we update on our website.
Meanwhile, the state of Alaska and others are keeping an eye on shorelines to see what washes up. The Department of Environmental Conservation paid for an aerial survey of the entire Alaska coast this year, the results of which are now being compiled. The Marine Conservation Alliance has been looking for tsunami debris on beaches as well. Founded by the fishing industry, the alliance has been doing beach cleanups for almost 10 years, picking up about 2 million tons of old nets, floats, and ropes, bottles, buckets, and whatever else accumulates, usually from fishing vessels. The organization found itself well-equipped to respond to the incoming debris from the Fukushima tsunami. Dave Gaudette runs the Marine Conservation Alliance Foundation's debris program.
We've been working since 2003 and cleanup projects throughout Alaska, and we had some experienced contractors in Craig, Sitka, Yakutat, and Kodiak. And we had them go down to the beaches that they knew well to see if there was anything unusual. These people have been on the beaches a lot, and so they know when there's something different.
What's been found so far is material that floats and catches the wind, material that can be blown across the Pacific much faster than 6 mile per day ocean currents. The MCA contractor in Craig found a basketball and sent it back to the Japanese middle school it came from. Sitka found about 1.5 tons of debris. Kodiak didn't find much of anything. Yakutat found quite a lot. More than 100 floats and buoys, almost 100 large styrofoam blocks, and almost 155 gallon drums. Nobody found anything radioactive, says Gaudette, though they did take precautions.
When we did the monitoring study in the springtime, we equipped all of our people with Geiger counters, and we did not get one indication that there was any radiation in any of the debris that we saw wash up.
While radiation may not be much of a concern, invasive species could be. Gaudette and Murphy are quick to note that invasive marine species are not likely to be found on debris that's washed up on shorelines because it dries out and is subject to a lot of abrasion. But large pieces of marine equipment that somehow get across the ocean could be an entirely different matter. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
The Federal Communications Commission is assessing current rules over how much mobile spectrum one company can own. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, some smaller mobile companies like those in Alaska are hoping it will give them a better chance to capture more high-quality airwaves.
Spectrum is the legal term for the airwaves. Current FCC law allows one company to own up to a third of the airwaves in any given area. Chris Gutman-McCabe is a vice president with CTIA, the Wireless Association. That's the trade and lobbying group for large mobile companies.
What we're asking the federal government to do is make available at auction the possibility to get additional bands of spectrum.
That could come as a rule change, allowing one company to have a larger percentage of the market. Gutman-McCabe says more access to more spectrum will allow companies to attract more users, and companies need to spend more money to keep them satisfied.
And then they turn around and spend, you know, tens of billions more as an industry each year to upgrade our technology, to build out to even additional areas.
The FCC plans to have broadcasters like TV stations give up some of its spectrum to make room for more mobile access. The FCC would sell that freed-up space and share some of the profits with the broadcasters. The current laws have been in place for about a decade. Think back 10 years, before the iPhone, before mobile apps. There wasn't as much demand for spectrum, because traditional cell phones do not use as much of the airspace. Regional providers hope the new rules will allow for a tighter cap on how much more spectrum big companies can snatch up. Kerry Bennett is general counsel to the Rural Telecommunications Group. It's an association of small providers like Copper Valley Wireless and Arctic Slope Telephone. She says the FCC's decision to move forward is a win for small companies because it could level the playing field with Verizon and AT&T. Companies, Bennett says, that are buying up spectrum and not using it, tamping down competition.
You can't go any higher than this. You got to utilize the spectrum that you have so that we can make room for other competitors to have a fair shot at competing with Verizon and AT&T. Even T-Mobile and Sprint may be struggling to get the spectrum that they need to compete.
The new guidelines would not necessarily take away existing spectrum from bigger companies, just regulate how much they could own in the future. And it's unclear how much of an effect the new rules would have on sparsely populated Alaska. Richard Cameron is senior counsel at Alaska Communications, ACS.
Alaska just isn't a market that is particularly spectrum constrained. There are already at least a dozen wireless providers in Alaska. There are several more that hold spectrum in Alaska that could enter the market if they want.
All cautioned that the changes will not come quickly. The FCC is now holding a public comment period. If the commission adopts the changes, an auction with the new guidelines could still be more than a year away. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the growing community of Samoans in Barrow.
They do take care of their community, and they harvest everything together and share it. That's how we do it back home, too.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
A fall can cause traumatic brain injury and require follow-up care outside of your home community. To help prevent falls, eat foods that are rich in calcium and vitamin D, like fish head soup and kelp with herring eggs. Be active, walk often, participate in subsistence activities, and have your vision checked at least once a year. More information at anthc.org. This message sponsored by the ANTHC Injury Prevention Program.
Pending a November court date, the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has placed a stay on work on the Port McKenzie Rail Spur in the Matanuska-Susitna Borough. The court is asking for a full review of the case following a lawsuit brought against the Federal Surface Transportation Board by environmental groups and individual citizens. On Monday, a three-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit questioned whether the Surface Transportation Board complied with the National Environmental Policy Act in determining the purpose of the Port McKenzie Railroad Extension Project. Bob Shavelson represents Cook Inlet Keeper, one of the organizations that brought suit against the STB.
Court essentially ruled that the Surface Transportation Board just rubber stamped the environmental impact statement for this project, and they specifically honed in on the purpose and need and recognized that that there's really not a demonstrated purpose and need for this project, and it needs to be spelled out there so we know if we're making a smart decision dumping hundreds of millions of dollars of public money into this.
The Port McKenzie Rail Spur is a Matanuska-Susitna Borough project, although the rail in question and right-of-way for it belongs to the Alaska Railroad. The railroad applied for a permit to build 35 miles of track from Port Mac to Houston. The STB has approved the route, and an environmental impact study is complete. And less than a month ago, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers issued approval of a wetlands permit allowing construction of the rail spur to move forward. Patty Sullivan is a spokeswoman for the Matsu Borough.
The borough and others are certainly disappointed that there's a temporary stay on construction because it could affect more than 200 jobs. Three segments of the 32-mile rail link were ready to go. We would have had contractors on three different parts of the project all at work, all at once in the fall, and right now that's temporarily on hold.
Sullivan says rail access to Port McKenzie is necessary for expansion of the area's economy. Results from exploratory wells in North Slope shale oil deposits are encouraging. Anchorage-based Great Bear Petroleum is doing fieldwork aimed at determining if the unconventional crude source is economically recoverable. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Great Bear has drilled two test holes on state lease land south of Prudhoe Bay. Company president and CEO Ed Duncan says the drill cores have corresponded with geologic models.
The rocks are present at the depth we predicted, in the thicknesses that we predicted, with the kind of thermal maturity that we predicted, and the phase of petroleum that we predicted at the levels, at the intervals that have been penetrated. So the model that we started with has been proven, at least at that level of geological proof.
Duncan, who has 30 years of oil industry experience, says the exploratory drilling is just the first step in determining whether the shale oil is economically recoverable. Shale deposits need stimulation, like hydraulic fracturing, to bring rock-trapped crude to the surface. The technique requires a lot of wells, including an underground network of lateral piping. Duncan says Great Bear has a lot of work to do to determine whether North Slope shale has commercial potential.
We haven't drilled a lateral, we haven't fracture stimulated that, and we haven't flowed back that fracture stimulated lateral to test the commerciality. Commerciality is going to be dependent on production rate and ultimate recovery per well.
Duncan says the commercial assessment field work is scheduled for coming weeks. Duncan spoke at a public meeting on shale oil in Fairbanks Thursday. University of Alaska Fairbanks Vice Chancellor for Research and former state oil and gas director Mark Myers says as conventional oil declines, shale oil is the next big onshore potential.
You got to remember the source rocks that you're testing here are the same rocks that put the oil into Prudhoe, Kuparik, Endicott, Alpine, North Star, etc. So we're really just tapping the source that generated the oil rather than the oil that migrated into conventional structures. And the North Slope is probably, if not the most prolific basin in the world, very close to it in terms of its oil source rocks.
Myers says high oil prices and improving technology are leveraging shale oil development. Shale reserves are different from conventional oil in that they require a series of new wells throughout their multi-decade lifespan, an infrastructure and labor-intensive endeavor. Shale oil booms in Montana, North Dakota, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and Texas have created tens of thousands of jobs in recent years. Great Bear has leased 500,000 acres of shale oil prospect lands on the North Slope. Fairbanks Senator Joe Pascvan, who organized Thursday's shale oil session, says if the Alaska resource pans out, the state has a lot to gain.
We're maybe 5 years from now that we are putting 500,000 barrels or more a day of shale oil into the taps line.
Pascvan attributes new oil investment in Alaska by independent companies like Great Bear in part to tax credits provided by the state. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The second in a series of science panels about the proposed Pebble Mine got underway today at the University of Alaska Anchorage Library. Panelists are discussing studies conducted in the Bristol Bay watershed near the proposed Pebble Mine site in southwest Alaska. Supporters say the panels will legitimize the science. Critics say that the panels, paid for by the Pebble Partnership, cannot be objective. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has more.
Bristol Bay Native Corporation went out of its shell and proclaimed to the world that we were against the Pebble Mine.
That's Joe Chithluk from Bristol Bay being cheered on by people protesting the Pebble Mine outside the University of Alaska Library. Protesters held signs critical of the Keystone Center's independent science panel process taking place at UAA this week. Inside, it sounded like this.
Welcome to the Keystone Center's second in a series of dialogues on the proposed development of the Pebble Mine. My name is Todd Bryan, and I'm a senior associate.
Todd Bryan is the man organizing the panels for the Keystone Center, the Colorado-based nonprofit organization that the Pebble Partnership hired to conduct the panels. Through the panels, scientists are being asked to evaluate studies in a 27,000-page environmental baseline document that the Pebble Limited Partnership released earlier this year. They've hired Keystone Center to determine whether those studies are credible and sufficient. They say the studies being scrutinized could be used to monitor changes in the environment if the mine goes through. Pebble officials say the scientists are not compensated, but they confirm they paid Keystone just shy of $1 million to organize the panels. Brian.
We're doing this in a very public forum where we're bringing in the consultants who did the baseline studies for Pebble, and we're bringing in our science panel members who have a lot of expertise in evaluating those kinds of studies.
During his opening remarks, Brian outlined the steps his organization was taking to ensure that the Keystone Center process is independent of the Pebble Limited Partnership's influence.
Regarding our independence and the independence of the science panels, the Keystone Center is following National Research Council policies to ensure that our science panels provide the most objective, independent, and unbiased review possible.
One of the scientists from the panel, University of Washington professor David Montgomery, recently resigned. He says he believes the panel investigation is flawed because it does not compare the baseline studies to a mine plan.
I started having the realization that it was very difficult, in my mind at least, to have a very solid take on the adequacy of the baseline data for impact assessment and risk assessment without actually having knowledge of what the plan would be, what the design of the mine would be.
Pebble Partnership CEO John Shively says not having a mine plan is not a problem.
A mine plan, I don't think, is essential to studying sort of the methodology of our science, how we quality check it. He's the only one of all the scientists that they've picked that said that. So not everybody felt that that was a necessary part of the process.
Pebble officials say a mine plan, which was scheduled to be released this fall, will likely be presented to the public in 2013 or 2014 and will be part of a discussion during a later panel. Another researcher, Daniel Schindler, was dismissed for alleged bias due to opinion pieces he wrote on issues surrounding the development of the Pebble Mine. During the panel discussions, scientists covered geology, hydrology, and water quality. Presenter Jane Whitsett gave an overview of study areas via a projected map.
We've zoomed in now, and you can see Lake Iliamna there. And the deposit now is it's that pink dot to the north of Lake Iliamna. And you see different colored polygons there, and those are depicting different study areas.
Members of the public weighed in on what they were being told. Lindsay Bloom with Trout Unlimited said she wondered what the questions were that drove the scientists doing research for the baseline studies.
I think data is controlled by the question that's asked when you seek to collect it, and I'm very concerned about the questions that were asked. I think that there is something to hide, that they're not presenting that today.
Some complain that the panels should have been held in the Bristol Bay region rather than in Anchorage. The panels will continue next week, October 9th through the 11th, with a different group of scientists discussing fish, wildlife, socioeconomic issues, cultural issues, and subsistence. A date is not yet set for the fourth and final panel, which will likely include a discussion of the yet-to-be-released mine plan. The Keystone Science panels are open to the public, but you must register to attend. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance. October is Energy Awareness Month, and the Alaska Energy Authority, along with its partners, say the average homeowner saves $1,200 annually after an energy audit. Learn how to be energy smart. Visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
Last week, the Bristol Bay community of Naknek celebrated the official opening of a new multi-use trail near the school, known as the Sockeye Run Fitness Trail and Bike Path. The trail is 5 years and some 200,000 in the making, and as KDLG's Dave Benninger reports, was completed thanks to the work of multiple agencies, countless volunteers, and one dedicated young girl with a vision.
Well, down there, it really starts down there at the end of the road. And then after you walk up through that, it's basically...
The voice you're hearing there is 13-year-old 8th grader Isabel Babiak, walking along the new 2-mile Sockeye Run Fitness Trail and Bike Path. She remembers the day the borough planner came to her 3rd grade class looking for ideas like it was yesterday.
She asked us what we thought the community needed, and I just, well, after being in Dillingham when I was in kindergarten and preschool, I thought, oh, that's kind of cool. We should have a trail like they have. And so that's what I said, and they thought that was a great idea.
With a plan for the trail in hand, 8-year-old Isabel went to the next meeting of the borough assembly.
We wrote out on a map of the school and the pool and the post office, this whole area. And with a Sharpie, we just drew out where we thought it should go. And then they said, oh, that's borough property. So, oh, that would work. So, and that's kind of how it started. It just was an idea and then a plan, and then it... That's just kind of happened, and that's what we're standing on right now.
Getting from that borough assembly meeting to the trail today took jumping through a lot of hoops. She learned about the piles of paperwork and bureaucracy that go along with projects, the kind, it's safe to say, would deter many adults from seeing it through. It was also a 5-year civics lesson, with insight to the workings of local government, how grants get proposed, and volunteers get corralled. She and her mom agree it was a learning process.
What do we usually say?
There's a lot of planning and planning a plan.
The community met Friday at noon to cut a ribbon and celebrate the grand opening. The trail cuts through birch, willow, and alder trees as it pleasantly winds near the school, clinic, pool, senior center, and ball fields in Naknek. Will the trail someday meander all the way to downtown Naknek, as some hope? Perhaps another ambitious third grader with a Sharpie and a vision is already drawing up plans for an expansion. Reporting for KDLG, I'm Dave Benninger.
The demographics of Alaska, including rural populations, are changing in some unexpected ways. Between 2000 and 2010, the population of Pacific Islanders in the state doubled to more than 12,000. And they aren't just in the state's urban centers. More than 3% of Barrow residents identify as Pacific Islanders. As part of our series looking at rural life in Alaska, APRN contributor Ann Hillman spoke with members of Barrow's Samoan community to find out how the island from the far south fit into the small community of the far north.
Living in Barrow is just like living in American Samoa. No, seriously. Listen.
The way up here is just like back home, how the roads and how, you know, house down there. But it's like almost the same. It's not a big change to me.
Lucilla Fotukava sits behind her reception desk at the eye clinic in Barrow, her favorite Polynesian music playing in the background. She grew up in American Samoa, but moved to Barrow from Anchorage in 2008 to help her sister take care of her kids and to find work. She says Samoan and Inupiaq cultures are very similar.
To compare Barrow's culture is like a little bit, but it's like almost the same like back home culture.
Mark Suesue, another Samoan, agrees. There are many similarities.
They do take care of their community. You know, they share and they harvest everything together and share it. That's how we do it back home too, which I do respect that. I love, you know, Inupiaq culture.
Suesue says the shared cultural values made it easy for him to adjust to living in Barrow and to become part of the community. He moved up to Barrow after working in fishing communities when he married an Inupiaq woman. He even joined her family's whaling crew. His first hunt was last spring.
Oh, wow. At first I thought I was like, okay, I'm from the islands. I'm strong. I can be stronger than these guys.
He quickly learned he was wrong. He was pulled over bumpy ice in a sled for 2 hours, then immediately had to help set up camp before going on watch for the whales. When the time came to get into the boat...
And I was nervous. I was scared. I was just scared because this boat wasn't even balanced. It's just shaking back and forth, side to side, or side to side. It's just a scary feeling. You don't have no life vest on. You're just out there with your whaler parka, as you say.
Suesue says the experience made him respect his new family and their strength even more, though it didn't exactly help him understand the environment.
Can't believe we still can't breathe up here in Barrow without trees.
Joining a Inupiaq culture wasn't as easy for Fotokava. She said at first she felt unwelcome and the people would look at her strangely, but she and her Tongan husband have tried to overcome that. They're building relationships with their neighbors by sharing home-cooked Samoan foods. She says she's even started liking some local foods, like pickled muktuk.
First of all, I never like eat because of the smell. And then suddenly, I taste like 4 of them. Now I want a whole jar, you know, eating the pickled muktuk. That's my favorite one, is pickled muktuk. It's great.
But she doesn't immerse herself in the local culture the way Suesue does. Fotokava said she still feels tension between people in the community, so she spends all of her time at work, at home, or at the gym, and socializing with family. Despite that, she's made a home in Barrow that she loves.
I have 11 grandkids up here, and they all participate besides babies. Oh, I love it up here. Jobs are good.
Though Barrow may not look anything like the sunny southern Pacific islands where Suesue and Fotokava grew up, they both plan to stay for the long haul. They say the cold climate offers a warm community for both Samoans and Inupiaq. For APRN, I'm Ann Hillman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Dave Benninger in Naknek. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C., Steve Heimel from Anchorage, and Ann Hillman from Barrow. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. The Kinnick Arm Bridge will create a second link between the Mat-Su and Anchorage for use during highway closures, emergencies, and as a potential evacuation route. For more facts on the Kinnick Arm Bridge, visit kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. Breastfeeding leads to healthy babies and healthier mothers. Women who breastfeed are less likely to get breast or ovarian cancer, and babies get fewer ear infections, score higher on IQ tests, and are less likely to be obese as adults. The road to lifelong health begins with breastfeeding. Call 907-465-3100 if you have questions about breastfeeding. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services WIC program, an equal opportunity employer.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.